Hello and welcome to another episode of LiveWire's Rules of Investing. Today's episode will be hosted by LiveWire co-founder and executive director, James Marlay. This week's guest is Simon Marwini, Chief Investment Officer of Allan Gray. Allan Gray, the firm, was set up by the man of the same name in 1973, and it now manages over $45 billion US dollars for clients globally. Since inception, Allan Gray and its sister company, Orbis, have produced returns comparable to that of Berkshire Hathaway. As a result, Allan Gray became one of South Africa's richest men before donating his entire holding in the company to charity in 2013. The firm came to Australia in 2005, but it was a bumpy start for the contrarian investment house. They stuck to their guns, however, and managed to produce an amazing 55.1% return in 2009. In this interview, we hear about the feast and famine nature of contrarian investing, why a long-term approach is essential, and hear Simon's contrarian case for Telstra. I hope you enjoy the show.
Tom, thanks. Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. I'd love to learn, as a starting point, about Allan Gray as a firm and the history of the firm and where the philosophy behind Allan Gray's investment approach is grounded. I was wondering if you could sort of give me the intro.
Yeah, okay. Allan Gray, the man, worked for Fidelity for some time, and after leaving Fidelity, went to South Africa and set up what is now South Africa's largest independent fund manager, called Allan Gray. And so the philosophy really was something that Allan instilled in the organization from the time he created it. It is a contrarian philosophy, and it's one that has not evolved since, but one that's been implemented since its beginnings of Allan Gray Limited in South Africa in the late 70s. And one that we continue to practice and invest along with today, and not only here in Australia, but also still in South Africa and elsewhere in the world.
And Allan Gray, as an investor, I imagine he had to have a firm and a philosophy named after. He must have had some pretty cracking results.
Yes, not always great, though. There's a lot of volatility. The strategy's always been a very high conviction, benchmark unaware one, and so it's feast and famine. But yes, over long periods of time and since inception, Allan Gray's track record has been reasonably good. And one of the reasons why we have even greater conviction in our investment philosophy, it seems to have stood the test of time.
Yeah. And so by definition, or just to clear up for people that are watching this interview, how do you define a contrarian approach?
Yeah, at its most basic, it's buying things that other people can't find the stomach or willpower to buy, stuff that's vilified in the press, things that have had a significant amount of bad news attached to them, or companies that are in a deep cyclical trough, which is prolonged, and there's an element of capitulation amongst the investor base, and companies where the immediate prospects are bleak. Many investors invest with catalysts in mind, and if you can't see a catalyst, the easiest thing to do is just not to bother investing in that particular company. But catalysts are quite elusive, and it's usually the bus you don't see that kills you, and it's equally the bus you don't see that gives you a lift home. And so those are the companies we're generally attracted to, ones where you can buy them where the future's bleak, and if the future just turns out to be bad, your investment is a good one.
Mm. And so what was your first exposure to Allan Gray and contrarian investing? How did you get lured?
Yeah, so I was desperate, and so was the person who hired me, Simon Marais, who was the founder of Allan Gray in Australia. And he was desperate. He had arrived in, set the business up in 2005, having left Orbis as the chief investment officer. Orbis is our sister company. And he came to Australia to set up Allan Gray and needed some help. And I had recently completed my CFA studies and was very interested in doing some full-time research. And he agreed that I could spend 50% of my time doing research and 50% of my time helping set up the fund and launch it and get our AFSL, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And 50% was a lot less than the 100% I wanted, but it's a lot more than the 0% I had. And so it was really a meeting of two desperate people, and as luck would have it, I ended up joining and I haven't regretted it ever since.
Mm. And is there a moment, I mean, about the style of investing, the contrarian approach, is there a moment that you can recall, or a particular discussion that you had that convinced you that this is how you wanted to invest?
Not really. I mean, I wish I could say I was sitting back around a dining room table reading the newspaper and had this epiphany, but it was definitely not like that. It sort of evolved over time. I'd read some stuff. I have always been very cynical and questioning, which I think is a great attribute from an investment perspective and terrible from a relationship perspective. But and as a result, I think it's just something that was, through osmosis, it sort of entered my investment vocabulary, really. And it was working with Simon for 10 years that really formed my investment view and built, and from that I built onto my contrarian investment style. And it's just worked for me. It's not every style is for everyone. Sure, there's multiple styles that probably work, but I don't mind being different and investing in things that other people can't stomach.
In 2008, which was only a few years after you started at Allan Gray, the flagship fund, or the Allan Gray Australian Equity Fund, was down 45.9% that year, which to date, as I understand, is the year that had the largest, still the fund's largest drawdown year. Can you tell me about that experience, given it was relatively early in your time?
Yeah, so that was quite a torrid experience, and you can. We've always said that we're not good trend investors. There was a particular group of companies that contributed to the majority of that underperformance, and they were the REITs. We didn't own them going into the financial crisis. They traded at a premium to book or to NTA, net tangible assets, and didn't seem like attractive investments. And then not long into the financial crisis, they fell to levels below book value, and then to levels quite a lot below book value. And it was around about when they got to 75% of book value that we started buying these companies. And of course, a bit like a falling piano, you want to make sure you pick the thing up very close to the ground floor, because it's going to get there. And of course, when we started buying these things at 75% of book value, it turned out they were nowhere near the ground floor, and they later fell to 50% of book value and 25% of book value. And then I think the lowest one got was 4.5% of book value, and that was Centro Retail Trust, which is the subsidiary of Centro Properties. Centro Properties went bankrupt, but Centro Retail Trust lives today just under a different name. Mm. And in that process and catching those falling pianos, and at the time the REITs were close to 30% of our portfolio, we had a very large drawdown, but it felt right, but very awkward. And we continued holding it. And when the financial crisis passed, those companies went up manyfold, even when management themselves did some value-destroying transactions which eroded shareholder value. They still went up a lot.
Mm. Well, that was going to be my follow-on, because you sort of, it sounds like a bit of a white knuckle moment, but the following year, the fund delivered 55% returns, which to date is the strongest year of performance as well. How did you hold your line through that period to investors and as an investment team?
I think much of that, if not all, should be credited to Simon Marais, who at the time was the chief investment officer. But more philosophically, our firm's investment philosophy is to invest with a long-term horizon in mind. And if you can find something which is cheap and it later falls 50% in value, or price, not value, and fundamentally nothing has changed, well, it's a half-price sale relative to when you initially had bought it. And so at its basic, those are things that we're happy to continue buying and put in the bottom drawer for 5 to 10 years and wait to see. And ordinarily, you would like to exercise some patience on the way down. We try to, but as I mentioned earlier, we're very bad trend investors. Unfortunately, we'd like to be better, but it's not something we're very good at picking tops and bottoms.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's instilled in us. We accept failure in as far as failure is considered to be underperformance relative to our benchmark. We have a portfolio which is very different to our benchmark, and as a result, we expect to perform very differently to our benchmark from time to time, both positively and negatively. And yeah, I think it's probably in the most direct answer to your question would probably be we have this 5 to 10 year investment horizon, and what happens in 1 year doesn't necessarily determine what our action is.
Mm. You recounted the story of one investment that did go to zero. That sounds like it's potentially one of the pitfalls of contrarian investing. What are some of the, how do you question your team internally? What's the internal process? Or can you give me a sense of how you go to avoid those scenarios? Because clearly they're undesirable.
Mm, yeah. Everyone talks about these things as value traps, and whether or not a company goes to zero is irrelevant if the alternative is it falls 99%, right? I mean, the damage has been done. So you want to try and avoid these companies which, for whatever reason, and usually debt has something to play, or the asset is not particularly good, but where it falls a significant amount. And I think you're right. It is probably one of the pitfalls of deep value contrarian managing or investment management. From time to time, unfortunately, you're going to be stuck with one of these things. It comes with the territory. One of the things you have to do is continue to take risks, educated risks, and in so doing, accept that sometimes the probabilities move against you and not in a way that you or your clients will like, but to make sure that you have a portfolio which is reasonably diverse and can tolerate that type of outcome. But from time to time, we have, and from time to time, we will continue to inadvertently invest in companies which materially underperform and at times go bankrupt. But cash flows are generally one good reason or one good way in which you can determine whether it's likely or not that that'll happen. And certainly no company with no debt ever went bankrupt, and companies that are servicing their debt and have reasonable cash flows are less likely to go bankrupt. But equally, they're the ones that don't get sold off as heavily.
Mm. Yeah. What are some of the scenarios or the situations that you now notice repeat themselves that present opportunities for a contrarian investor? What are you scouring for? Because as a fund manager, you need to be evaluating and assessing new opportunities.
I don't think there's one set of conditions which make for fertile stock picking. I think it changes from time to time. And if it were that easy, I think everyone would do it and no one would be able to outperform. But a very large underperformance relative to the stock market is always fertile ground for identifying stocks that may look attractive.
Mm.
But a lot of fundamental research on the back of that would be necessary, because there's no point in being contrarian for contrarian's sake.
Yeah.
I think you would have a disproportionate number of your investments go bankrupt on you. But cyclically exposed companies, when there's a cyclical downturn, are generally reasonably good companies to invest in. And I think at its most basic, the cycle plays the biggest role from an input into our investment process.
Mm-hmm.
If you can invest in things where they're cyclically exposed and not structurally impaired, then when the cycle turns in your favor, you probably do quite well, provided you buy these things at a reasonable price to begin with. So identifying, taking the universe of ideas, let's just say there's 300 stocks in the ASX 300, and identifying which cycles drive the company's underlying performance and where the company is in that cycle is what we spend most of our time doing.
Mm. I notice a lot of your top 10 positions, maybe even four out of the top five, are related to a commodity cycle of some description. I think it was gold, oil, aluminium, from memory. Is that reflective of your view that, you know, maybe not on the bottom, but it's still at a reasonable point in the cycle for those commodity businesses?
Yeah, so energy has for a long time been a very significant, well, I say a long time, since about 2015, been a very significant overweight for us. It's been about 30% of our portfolio, and I don't know what its weight in the benchmark is, but it's considerably less than 10%. And so that is very much a, I'll say, a theme that we've invested in, noting that we don't invest in themes or take macro views of the world. It's bottom-up stock analysis, fundamental research. But at the end of the day, we've stumbled across three or four energy-exposed companies which we think are very attractively priced and have invested quite heavily in those. And then there are some select commodities or non-energy commodities that we've invested in, and you mentioned gold, that's one. Mm. It's not because we see some impending doom or that we have some amazing insight into what the Fed is going to do. It's really because we think that the underlying commodity price is too low, and were it to right itself to something which we think is sustainable, a particular company or group of companies would do quite well on the back of that.
Yeah.
And then aluminium is very much the same, though our aluminium investments go back some years now, and some of that thesis has played out already. Aluminium prices are up a lot.
And are
now reasonable at current levels to entice new supply, and so perhaps it's time to look elsewhere.
Well, we might come back to there's a few points in the Australian market where I'd love to get your views or just assessment about changing landscapes and outlooks for companies, but wouldn't mind just changing tack to the subject of incentives. I know it's a topic that you've had some interest in the past. It seems topical right now. We've had investigation into financial advice where it appears that people were surprised by the outcomes given how advisors were incentivised. With respect to listed companies, I'd love to just get a synopsis of how you view the way that CEOs and management should be incentivised and how you think it distorts or alters their behaviours.
Yeah, I mean, this. I'm not going to be Robinson Crusoe with this. A lot of people have previously said that, you know, you show me an incentive scheme and I'll show you how someone acts. But there's probably five things that we look at, broadly speaking, in incentives. And the quantum is one, and it's fairness. But putting that aside, people will have their own opinions as to how much listed company CEOs get paid and whether it's fair or not. We have never really focused on the quantum. It's too difficult, really, to take some of what a particular CEO gets paid out of their back pocket. But we have felt that it's a little bit easier to put something different into their back pocket. And so there's four other things that we focused on, and I'll probably forget one of the four, but long-term focused is important. Too often remuneration schemes are based on this year's performance, when oftentimes a company's strategies might bring forward performance from later years so as to make the current year look that much better, and basically short-termism, which is not something we like. Symmetry, I think good jobs deserve to get paid very well, but bad jobs need to be paid poorly as well, and mm-hmm. I think it's only fair. You can't have a heads I win, tails you lose scenario, which is often the case. Aligned with shareholder interests, so if shareholders do well, management does well, and conversely, if shareholders do poorly, management do poorly. And I thought I might, I've forgotten the fourth. But those are the basics which we think are important to us. And it's perhaps a illustrative of how cynical I am. But when a remuneration scheme is heavily skewed away from these four or five key metrics, we can't help but question management initiatives or decisions on the back of those and wonder how much of it is incentive driven and how much of it is for the long-term interests of its shareholders. Mm. And time again, management are paid for short-term outcomes, often at the expense of long-term value creation for shareholders. Mm-hmm. And it's that we have issues with.
Yeah. To focus on the positive, are there examples of companies out there that you think are really setting the standard when it comes to incentivizing and alignment? And does the performance of those companies, is it consistent with what you would like to see?
Well, in the interest of a balanced response, I'll start off with saying, yes, there are companies, but AMP is one of them.
Right.
So, but in fairness, AMP from 2018 has implemented a remuneration framework which achieves most of the things that we like, but pre-2018 had a remuneration framework which didn't achieve these things. So AMP, QBE is another, and Wesfarmers is the third large company that actually does embrace many of these things, where management are paid in shares. And they're required to hold those shares for a number of years, ideally a number of years after they leave the company, because mm-hmm. too often you have the management team of a company dress a company up as something that it actually isn't. And it's only 6, 12, even 24 months after they leave that you realize, geez, actually, this person was paid for lamb and we've sitting with a bunch of mutton here, and it just, it's not fair. Whereas if their remuneration was in shares and they held these shares post-employment, then the new CEO that comes in and says, actually, well, this actually is not so good, and our prospects are nowhere nearly as good as the previous CEO, had you believe, the share price would adjust accordingly, and the previous CEO's value of his remuneration would also adjust along with that, because their shares would have been escrowed for a period of time. Mm-hmm. And that's the alignment aspect, which I think is quite important. But yeah, there's a few other smaller companies that also do this, but it's definitely not mainstream.
So for investors that are out there wanting to incorporate or at least make themselves aware of sort of the good and the bad practices, could you sort of aligning it to, you're saying avoid companies with excessive pay where the downside is, you know, or the underperformance is not recognised the same way that outperformance is recognised, and the remunerations around goals that are beyond 1 or 2 years, it's sort of that 5-year view.
Yeah, well, I think be attracted to companies where the management team is paid based on metrics which will impact you as an investor. So we're not a big fan of share price performance because it can be quite short term, but share price performance is one. Earnings per share is another. Return on equity is another. Mm. And how their remuneration is paid, preferably in shares, so that they are invested alongside you. And then avoid companies where their remuneration is based on things which actually mean nothing to you, revenue growth. Because you can be sure that if a CEO is incentivized on how much the revenue grows, they will make damn sure the revenue grows, but the profit may not grow at a similar rate. In fact, if anything, it might actually go backwards. Mm. You can't buy a share of a company's revenue. All you can do is buy a share of a company's profits.
Yeah. AMP, it was one of the examples that I've noted down about companies where there's bad headlines and people feeling some distress. What's your view on how things play out for a company like AMP, a very large organisation that's really, you know, there's plenty of reasons for people to turn away from it at the moment?
Mm. Yeah, it's hard to say. We have done and are doing quite a lot of research on AMP. We don't own it yet. We haven't owned it before either. And we don't generally like to comment on companies which are burning research initiatives of ours. But we're spending a lot of time trying to quantify the downside with AMP. It's difficult to know what the Royal Commission will recommend and how the company might reinvent itself, if at all, and what that means to its future profits, which is the important aspect to get one's head around. And in understanding the downside, it will help us in sizing a position, if any. I didn't mention it beforehand, but with contrarian investment, we tend to focus a lot on the downside and where we might be wrong. Generally, the upside looks after itself. And too much focus on the upside leads to an element of chest-beating arrogance and the kiss of death. And so we tend just to focus on the downside, and that's exactly where we're focusing on AMP at the moment. And it seems there is a reasonably balanced level of downside relative to the upside at the moment. Mm-hmm. But of course, it's too early to say. We haven't finished our research, but it is one that we're looking at very closely.
Yeah. I get the sense from your body language that it's quite a hot potato, so I won't push you too hard on that one.
It's literally work in very strong progress for us at the moment.
No worries. I've got one more which I know I have seen on your published holdings, and it's another one that I think will be topical for readers and one that's making negative headlines, which is Telstra.
Oh yes, yeah, we do own Telstra.
Yeah. Just interested in, again, you know, that's a sector, the whole sector is challenged, and, you know, there's dividend support that people felt like would provide a bit of a base for that company, but there really does appear to be a lot of uncertainty still. I'd just love to get a synopsis from you on how you've considered that investment.
Yeah. So expanding on the downside scenario, we've looked at Telstra with a view to how bad it could get from here, and if it is reasonably bad, how much are you paying for it, to get a sense of our downside risk. And what we've done is we've taken away the NBN receipts, which the company won't have post 2020, which of course everyone has done. It's not difficult to do that. We've also taken a reasonably significant chunk of its NBN impacted earnings out. So it moves from obviously being an infrastructure owner to a reseller of NBN. Yeah. And in that process, the company has flagged that its earnings will be impacted to a degree. And so we've removed that. Again, that's something that most investors could do it themselves. We've taken an assessment of what mobile earnings are likely to fall by as a result of the increased competition by TPG. And taken a very, very modest assumption on what the cost out the company can achieve is. And based on all of that, you get to somewhere in the region of $3 to $3.5 billion of free cash flow that the company could reasonably expect to make, let's say $3 billion. And based on Telstra's current enterprise value, that's not a crazy outcome for a reasonably severe profit or cash flow result. And it's not that much more expensive than the stock market in aggregate. And then if you flip the coin over and you say, is there anywhere where Telstra could do decidedly better than this? And I think there are a number of places, very difficult to quantify, but one of them is on their cost out. It could be much higher than the $1.5 billion that they've led the market to believe. You would hope they could do a lot better than that. There must be a lot of low-hanging fruit sitting around Telstra. Mobile may not be as bad as we fear. And it may be that 5G and their network application and services business is a growing business that offers other revenue streams which they don't currently have. And those would be some of the upsides that we don't like to focus on. We tend more to say, how bad does it get? $3 to $3.5 billion in free cash flow. Would you buy it? Well, if that's the outcome, it's not going to make you rich, but it's not going to make you poor either. And so we do sense now that the risks are skewed towards the upside. There's, or said differently, there's an asymmetric payoff profile today, and it's we think, to the positive end of the spectrum rather than the downside. And as a result, we've taken a small investment in Telstra and stand ready to increase it. They're having their investor day soon, I think next week. And it'll be interesting to see what they do and what messages they send on the back of that.
Yeah, interesting. I think I'll wrap up our investing style questions there. Just at a personal level outside of investing, can you give me an insight into the sort of things that stimulate you other than investing?
Yeah, sure. I love my own time. I'm an avid reader of almost anything. Yeah. When I can, I like to windsurf. As a family, we like the outdoors. Trying to think what else.
What are you reading at the moment?
I haven't got a... Airport Trash novel. Not very good, but... like I said, I'll read anything. But nothing that your viewers would be particularly interested in. Yeah, family is always a big pull.
Commitment.
But yeah, I mean, it's any downtime I can have. I try where possible to spend it outside. And if it's a reasonably windy day, I'll windsurf. I'm not very good at it, but it's still an easy way to forget about most things. And then just catching up on reading. Most of the stuff I read at the moment are more periodicals and other investment manager research pieces, less novels at this stage, but yeah, that even goes in and out of cycles, yeah. Usually holiday time.
So. Very good, interesting. Well, listen, I really appreciate you coming down and
no worries.
Teaching us a bit about how you invest and telling a few stories, and wish you all the best with investing, hopefully not catching too many more pianos on the way down.
I'm sure there'll be a few, but thank you, James. Thanks for having me.
Great, thank you.
Okay.